Ciao a tutti, welcome to Engines of Creation podcast. I'm your host, Cristian Mastrovnato. In this podcast, I bring together my knowledge in complex systems with my experience in leading technology innovation and new product development to explore how successful products, organizations, and ideas emerge. Last time, I promised you an episode in February, and I just about missed the target, but I'm sure this insightful episode is worth the wait, as we delve into the multifaceted world of AI with an extraordinary guest, Ricardo Baeza-Yates, whose extensive background in computer science and research sets the stage for a deep dive into the ethical and practical dimensions of artificial intelligence. Among many things, Ricardo has been VP of research at Yahoo Labs. He wrote one of the most influential books on information retrieval, and is now one of the most influential voices in the responsible AI field. Responsible AI is the central topic of this fascinating conversation, and Ricardo emphasizes its importance, advocating for systems that are not only legally and ethically sound, but also beneficial to society at large. He underscores the necessity of possessing the right competencies to develop AI responsibly, including technical expertise and a thorough understanding of the domain in question. The conversation touches on the need for transparency, privacy, and non-discrimination in AI systems, highlighting the potential risks and the imperative to mitigate them. We also discuss the critical role of quality management and risk assessment in AI, drawing attention to the real-world consequences of algorithmic decisions, including life-threatening scenarios. The conversation acknowledges the complexity of the systems and the importance of rigorous evaluation to prevent harm. In particular, we explore the concept of non-human errors, where AI systems might inadvertently create categories or biases that do not exist in reality, such as racial classifications. This segues into a discussion on the risks posed by AI, where flawed systems can lead to significant political and social upheaval, as exemplified by the Dutch government's resignation over a scandal exacerbated by algorithmic decision-making. Ricardo shares his vision of what an AI utopia might look like, shaped by the positive impacts of AI, imagining a future where technology enhances human capabilities and addresses pressing global issues. The discussion invites listeners to consider whether the current direction of AI development aligns with these ideals. Finally, the interview underscores the importance of taking a long-term view when considering the development and implementation of AI. It highlights the need for ongoing conversation and understanding about complex systems and their implications, ensuring that AI evolves in a way that is beneficial and sustainable for future generations. This is my longest interview so far, but I'm sure it is worth it since it left me, and I'm sure it will leave you with a comprehensive understanding of nuanced and critical considerations that must be addressed as we navigate an evolving landscape of artificial intelligence. So, let's go! Welcome to Engines of Creation, Ricardo. Thanks a lot for making the time to join us today. So it's really a pleasure, and this is going to be a great conversation. I think the best way to start is to start from an introduction. I know you have actually a Wikipedia page, so I'm sure some of the listeners might want to have a look to that, but definitely would be great to hear from you what you did in the past, but definitely also what your interest now. So welcome again to our podcast.
Thank you, Chris, for the invitation to do this podcast. So I did my PhD in computer science in Canada a long time ago. There I started my career as a researcher, first in Chile. Then I moved to Spain as an ECREA professor, which is like a good position for any researchers in Catalonia. And then I had this opportunity to start Yahoo Labs in Europe. So I convinced them to do it in Barcelona, which was like an experiment, like a big lab in Barcelona, and that worked very well. I had up to 50 people in Barcelona, and also helped Yahoo to start the labs in Haifa, Israel, also later in London. I did a small one in Latin America, in Chile, my native country. And I was 10 years the VP of research for Yahoo. The last 2 years I moved to Silicon Valley, where I became the chief research scientist of Yahoo, like the number two in research. And then Yahoo was sold to Verizon, so all research was disbanded. And I became a CTO of a software company for 4 years, software company devoted to semantic search, and search is one of my main expertise. But at the same time, I started to work on bias in algorithmic systems, bias in AI. And then when that company ended in 2020, partially because of the pandemic, I joined this new institute for experiential AI at Northeastern University. Northeastern University's main campus is in Boston, but many people don't know has 13 campuses in three countries, one in London. Maybe you don't know the new Humanities University is part of Northeastern now, near the London Bridge, and also two in Canada. And there I lead the research team, and we have five areas of focus, three verticals, which are life sciences, health, and climate and sustainability, and two more core AI topics where more directly involved. One is in generative AI, and the other one is responsible AI, which is my main interest these days.
Okay, that's really interesting, and it's really broad, and I think that's the value that you definitely bring in the conversation.
Maybe something that I would like to add is that more than almost 25 years ago with a friend in Brazil, we decided to write a book on information retrieval, so the technology of search, which was crazy because the two South Americans writing a book, but that book became the most cited book on the field. So this is like, also I think interesting that there was an outlier that becomes the most cited book on search.
To be fair, that's where I first knew you before meeting you in person when we both were involved in the advisory board of the Barcelona Technology School. By far not at your level, but I definitely played with search and semantic search in my past as well. So in that sense, yes, you are a well-known name for the people that work in the search and information retrieval world. And that's also why I was referring to your Wikipedia page earlier. And no, that makes sense. And a lot of people are joining now into AI, interested by the potential and by the power of the technology. But the reality is that on the one hand, some of these issues have been around for quite a while, or at least, and when you talk especially of responsible AI, and you mentioned earlier about, I mean, bias and sort of similar issues in data. But on the other hand, it is also true that they are becoming more and more relevant now with introduction of larger language models. I always want to stress that it's not that they were less important before. I mean, we had a lot of examples with Facebook, another situation where the bias in data can, or in general, misuse of data can create problems. But definitely now, at least, it seems this power is spreading out and it's becoming bigger and bigger. So thinking from the perspective of the impact that AI can do, what are the right approaches or points of view that anybody working in the field or starting work in this field should look at?
Yeah, that's not an easy question because I think we are just starting on this road. It's like a long road. And partly we're starting because we're seeing problems. Otherwise, I don't think it would be that important. And problems that basically had the worst possible consequences, like people dying. Although much less than other problems, social problems that we have today. But I think, so I was co-author of one of the main authors of the new principles of the ACM. ACM is the largest association for professionals in the field. The new principles on responsible algorithmic system. And there I pushed for one principle that for me is the number one. Now it's the number one because also in the principle, there's some causality. So things are not random. So they have some order. And this is the first thing I think we need to worry about doing anything, which is the principle of legitimacy and competence. But basically, you need to show that your application is legitimate to society. That means it's legally valid, it's ethically valid. The benefits are much larger than the possible damages. And then you need to have all the competences to do it well. One trigger one, which sadly not always we check, is basically that you have the permission to do it. Like someone in the organization or whatever says, yeah, you can do it. Sometimes people don't ask and they do things that they shouldn't do. Like, for example, they don't have the competence in the administration to do that. And of course, they need to have all the other competence, like scientific competence, technical competence, the domain of the problem, and so on. Like sometimes computer scientists, I feel that they are answering things that they shouldn't answer because they are not experts on that topic. But you see papers where like, they talk about health and there's no doctor involved. And I don't understand these things. But this is the one thing. I think this is one thing like maybe it's like a auto-regulation in the sense that we need to be responsible and ask these questions about legitimacy and competence to start. Then we have all the classical principles like being transparent, taking care of privacy, trying to basically make sure that the system doesn't discriminate people, all the things that are typical in more like classical AI ethics principles. And then we need to be responsible and accountable. And this is the part, the last part, where I guess the only way to do that is to have a regulation. And then I guess the most advanced regulation so far is the one that was just leaked a few days ago, the last version of the EU Act. There are several leaks, not all of them are equal, so, but I guess this is the last version that is being basically approved by every country. They said that they agreed last December, but if you agree on something, you publish it, right? For some reason, it's not yet officially published. So the agreement is very weak in some sense. And I know that some countries are pushing for example, more open language models in the case of France. Others are more, they want to use facial recognition more easily, like maybe some country that have less democracy. There's a diversity of governments in the European Union. So this will be the first one. And if you read the details, this will not be put in practice in at least 2 years. So we are talking now, remember, the first version was 2021, and now we are maybe going to 2026. So 5 years later, we will have something. Now, this regulation is a big, huge experiment for me. I think that has many conceptual problems. The first, that is not really right to say only that AI should be regulated. Of course, we're talking about the use of AI. We're not regulating technology, we're regulating the use of technology. Because then you leave a loophole that you can say that if you don't use AI, you don't need to apply the regulation. And some people may do that. That's why the principles of the ACM are for algorithmic systems, not for AI. And of course, AI is the main danger, but this should be true for all algorithmic systems. Given that you are in London, I'm sure you saw what happened with the Horizon scandal. Is that finally is known because of a TV series, which also shows the power of media on basically exposing things that have been going on for years. And this is not about AI. This was accounting system that was not doing the proper job and accused many people of fraud that were innocent. And if a person didn't decide to fight the government and then become kind of a local hero, and someone decided to do a TV series about that, no one will know about this. No one will know about 4 people committing suicide or people being like more than a year in jail for things that they didn't do. So these things, I think, that is part of the issues that we have today, that in spite of being a global world, we don't see these cases so exposed like in this case. And in this case, the prime minister saw them serious. And really, he became worried. So this is the first thing. The second thing, I think, and then we can go in more detail, the second thing is that we have never regulated the use of technology before. This is like regulating the use of a hammer so you don't hit a person with a hammer. For me, it's like not the best way to do it. We need to regulate the problems for any technology, not for one technology. Because what will happen next, we'll regulate quantum computing. We need to regulate blockchain. We need to regulate anything new that we do in the future. This is a very painful path for even for lawyers.
How would you approach that from the perspective of even thinking about what is technology and then what is the right place where you would place the regulation? Is it at company level? Again, who is accountable for the technology, first of all? So is it the company that builds it? And what do you actually regulate? Is this sort of the testing phase, for example? So at the end of the process, or is it something earlier? How would you go with that?
Yeah. So let's talk a bit first about accountability, because you say, who is accountable? I think, I don't know why it's so complicated, because we have all the legal framework for accountability. Let's say you have a problem in your car. To whom you will complain? To the person that sold you the car. Or if it's an old car, you will fix it in the right place. But you never will think about, okay, is the maker of the part accountable? Is the person that designed the part accountable? This is the question that we are asking today regarding AI, which makes no sense to me. the person that sold you the brand, it's accountable, like in everything else.
What about open source? Where the accountability goes?
I guess with open source, it's really the problem is complicated because there, at the end, someone will put that open source. I think I will do the same parallel. Let's say if Meta puts something open source, they are accountable. But then if someone modifies that, they also have part of the accountability. Unless you can show that what you did, the changes you did in the model are not the ones that produce the problem. But these things can be very complicated because we know these are black boxes that are very hard to understand how they work. And you will need to do an audit to show that your change basically didn't change the output, for example. You can try that same model before or after your change, and then you can be free of any responsibility. However, as we know, open source will have many, many different changes, so this is not scalable if many people become involved. So maybe we need some regulation to make sure that we know what to do in those cases, and maybe we'll change from country to country. Now, before you told me what you will do. For example, for me, I think I would go back to this legitimacy and competence problem. Today, if you want to do any new large infrastructure, you need to go, for example, in most countries, you need to do an environmental assessment. What would be the impact of this large infrastructure on the environment and also on people? I think for any application that can modify the life of a person, that will have an impact on the life of a person, we should act the same. This would be my first simple regulation. You need to do a risk impact assessment where you show that your benefits are much larger than the possible damages. And this should be done to some special office of the government that basically will regulate the good use of technology. And this should be true not only for AI, for anything new. Because we will have more technologies. For example, we have all these technologies about, for example, neural connections to the brain, for example. That's another topic that I think will become important in the near future. What do we do to make sure that this is not a problem? So, yeah, for anything new technology, we should have this first risk impact assessment. Now, again, there is still a problem here. Risk is very hard to measure because risk is basically you need to estimate the probability of something happening, and also you need to know what will be the impact of that happening. And this is another problem of the EU AI Act. It's based on four levels of risk, and these four levels has three levels, the categories of high risk, low risk, and no risk, that really don't exist. This is another cognitive bias of human stuff, creating categories that don't exist because risk is a continuous variable, like the color of the skin, for example.
Let's stay on the EU regulation topic because as you mentioned, yes, it has definitely shortfalls. So one of the things I'm keeping asking myself, is it going to end up like GDPR? That kind of the thing I'm seeing there, okay? I understand that European Union, I would say historical and cultural reason, is pushing on compliance because that's basically the power they have. Okay, they don't have large companies like US or you might argue China and that large innovation power. And so they're trying to sort of create some level of control from the regulation and compliance side. But again, if you look at the GDPR experience, I don't think it achieved the original objectives. Now, there is nothing bad with that, I believe, because as you also talked about the UAI Act, if you take it as an experiment, you try and you want to see how it works and you want to iterate. But that's really, I believe, the problem with national and in case of the transnational institution, they don't iterate. Right. They build a regulation and it's stuck there and they don't learn from the mistakes or it might take 20 years to have another version of that. That's the place where I am at the moment. So is it going to be beneficial in that sense with all of these mistakes? And do you think that the EU and other sort of national entities can become a bit more agile in the way they learn from these mistakes and make better regulations, or we risk to actual regulation in a way to make more damages because it takes a lot of time to put it in place and then it doesn't evolve when it is there.
So let's start with a disclaimer. As I said, sometimes computer scientists talk about topics that they are not experts. I'm not a lawyer, so these are my personal opinions on regulations. So maybe I'm not the best person to discuss it. But let me go back to you with a question. Why do you think that GDPR is not working?
Because at the end, it, in many cases, it just became, it became sort of a cookie policy thing for many companies. That's the way I see that. Okay. So while the not necessarily, it might have created some awareness, but when you get down a certain level of granularity, the reality that you cannot even track the actual GDPR implementation because it's part of sometimes of the challenges of technologies. Okay. So when you have billions of small apps deployed everywhere, how can you actually check if they're following GDPR or not? And so, yeah, beyond the cookie setting on the website, has GDPR created any impact? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd be happy to be wrong, but I couldn't see any number that showed that GDPR created that impact so far.
I think I disagree because I think that the fines are, I mean, quite large, and then people implemented this. Maybe you're right in the sense that it's not easy to check if they have done it, but I think that they have the right negative incentive to do it. And for example, I gave this example for the UK with the Horizon system. The largest political impact of a system was the city system in Netherlands. And the main reason that the system was found illegal was because of GDPR, not because of something else. So it was about the data privacy. So I think in many interesting landmark cases in Europe, GDPR has helped to put the limits. And for example, in the case of the Netherlands, at the end, the whole government quit in January 2021. So, which is like a whole government quit because of a system. It's not a simple impact. It's like largest political impact ever of a system. And it's not really also AI, maybe partial AI, but I'm sure that part of the system, like data privacy, has nothing to do with AI. Now, GDPR, I think, has some problems. And I think I want to mention two because this will impact the EU AI Act regulation. I think the GDPR has a very interesting difference with all regulations that have been done before. GDPR tells you how to do it. GDPR regulation says, don't do this. GDPR is the opposite. You have to do it like this, which was another experiment, but seems that it was good because then the implementation is much more fixed. You know what you need to implement. I think the main problem is that is this one shoe fits all. Like a multinational has to do the same as the small newspaper place in, say, in Italy. And I know lawyers in Italy that are profiting by doing GDPR at all levels, like all the businesses in town. So very good for that lawyer. But basically,
in Italy, I would say, but definitely.
No, everywhere. But in some countries, I think this has been taken with more worry because they do more things than needed. Like I would say Norway, Italy, there are cases where you see why. Well, Norway is not in the EU, but they're still doing it. So yeah, I think this one shoe fits all was not good. And maybe you need to differentiate between like multinationals and small companies. And that was not that. So that's a bit, it's not easy because of equality and all that. But I think this was something that maybe no one knew what would be the impact on SMEs of this kind of regulation, which is a problem that we will see again in the EU AI Act. So multinationals will have an advantage because they have the resources to basically change whatever they need to change. A small business will be harder to comply, and we will see some inequalities there. How this will be enforced, I think this is part of the problem. Already part of GDPR was not enforceable, and I see the same mistakes in the EU Act. For example, in the original version, I think it's still there. you have this Article 5. It says that you cannot use any subliminal technique to, let's say, manipulate people that may cause some physical or psychological damage. Now, if you apply that to the world, then I shouldn't show an ad of fast food to a person with obesity, for example, morbid obesity, or like a cake to a person with diabetes. And that's impossible to enforce. And also, if you enforce it, if you say, okay, we forbid that, then all internet collapses, right? Because like advertising is basically what allows to have all these web services for free. So this is like a very nice conceptual idea that technically is impossible to enforce, like you were saying about GDPR, which is true. You don't have visibility in the implementation. That at the end doesn't make much sense.
The other point you made about the UII Act was about risk. And you made a great point, of course. Risk is a continuous. And yes, I have my own struggles when you see the low, medium, high risk and sort of things, which probably it's a debate for another podcast episode. But I think that specifically for AI and risk assessment is going to be a core exercise. So how would you approach, what is for you the right approach to look at quality management of whatever you build from? And again, it might be, probably it's not only about AI, as I said, it might be about technology in general. And how would you assess the risks associated with that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So auto-regulation there will not work, because you have a conflict of interest and you will try to push the risk as low as possible for your system. So that doesn't work. Now, if we need to do a risk assessment for all possible applications in the world, then you have a huge scalability problem. So how we do that? Now, one possibility will be that we have like a new market of companies doing risk assessments. But this market will have the same problem that today we have in the auditing, algorithmic auditing market, which is very small. So there are not too many companies that do algorithmic audits. And they have the following conflict of interest. If they are too tough on the assessments, you lose clients. And of course, you are living from that, but you don't want to lose clients. So it's very hard to do like a very fair audit or a very fair risk assessment, because if you say the truth, maybe the client will go to somewhere else. And then there was a very interesting article that by chance I found yesterday, completely by chance, but it's the problem. It's like, basically, who audits the risk assessors? Who makes sure that they are being fair and they are not trying to basically grow their business only because of this conflict of interest between their business and the output of their assessments? Maybe there we'll have to have a government organization that will check that audits or risk assessors will need to be certified, because the government cannot do it, cannot scale. So one possibility will be, okay, only the government does the risk assessment. That will be worse than health in the UK or something like that. Like, people will have to wait a long time to be able to have a risk assessment, because you will have tens of thousands of systems that need to be assessed. And of course, some systems are more dangerous than others. So these are the problems. These are very complicated problems where we don't have a solution yet because we haven't done it. But I see the risk. So these are the real risk of the systems. It's very hard to enforce, very hard to scale. And as you said, very hard to check that these things are in place.
That's very insightful. And also that leads probably closer to the, what can I say, to the core of your research. Related to risks and risk assessment, one concept that I've heard it phrased in that way by you is what you call the non-human errors. What are they, and what's their implication has been to risk and AI?
Thank you for the question. It's a very interesting topic. I started working with a PhD student like more than 2 years ago in this idea that AI can basically commit two types of errors. Errors that humans also do. Typical error of a human, just to make the very simple example, will be that if you ask a human in the street, what type of, let's say, dog is this dog, most people will not know they will go do an educated guess. They will say, oh, maybe this is a collie or a setter or whatever. But most people will do a mistake. Now, if you write an AI classifier of types of dogs, they also do these mistakes. So they will do some human mistake, but sometimes it's very hard to distinguish two dogs that are very similar and they have almost, for example, same color, but a slightly different characteristics because they are different species, super species. However, if you ask the question to a person again, a person will never say, oh no, this is not a dog, it's a cat, right? Like you will never confuse a cat with a dog. Sadly, AI does these mistakes. So even the state of the art, they will confuse a cat with a dog and also a dog with a cat because these are not symmetric. And well, these are the non-human errors. Errors that people will never do that maybe in some cases they are dangerous. For example, if you confuse a dog with a cat, you may be in trouble because the dog may attack you, right? But you will not say that the cat will attack you. And this is what happened. This is a real example. This is what happened in 2018 in Arizona when a self-driving Uber car killed a woman that crossed at night in the wrong place in a bicycle, and the car didn't recognize that she was a woman in a bicycle. I think this is a non-human error because I'm sure if you don't have any impairment, all people will recognize the woman in a bicycle and will stop at the right time. The car was not going fast. The problem is that they didn't recognize until it was too late. And the backup driver had 2 seconds to react. That's stupid. By the way, that's a very interesting example about accountability because Uber was not accountable for that accident.
Which I think lead to another point where there is a lot of analysis around the accuracy of a system and sort of looking at false positive and false negatives. But, and again, it's something I heard from you stated very clearly for the first time, mistakes are not equal. So that 0.01%, maybe it might have a very high impact and the non-human error, because it comes from an unexpected direction and the impact might be much higher. So it's not just about the mistake, but again, what's the impact of the specific mistakes and how do you analyze that, I guess?
Yeah, that's exactly. For example, if we go back to the self-driving cars, I would prefer to take a self-driving car that may be slower than the fastest one. But for example, assures me that no person will be killed on the way. It will be more like have a friend that will say it's a Buddhist car. The Buddhist car will be very careful, even with cows in the road. No one will damage. But if you have like a German car that will go very fast and be very punctual and in every place, but sometimes kills a person, that's a problem for me, even if the probability is very, very low. And this is the real dilemma for self-driving cars. I believe in self-driving cars. I think that they will kill less people than humans because they don't need to look at the phone. They don't need to sleep. They don't need to rest and so on. They don't need to eat. So it will be much better. The problem is that even though less people will be killed, they will kill some people that before was not in danger of being killed. And these are the non-human errors. If, for example, they will kill a woman crossing in a bicycle because the car didn't recognize that. Maybe they will kill old people because they were too slow. Or maybe they will kill kids that because they were too fast and cross suddenly to pick up a ball. And they look like a ball because they were picking up the ball. So they didn't have the classical shape of a person. So basically, we will save a lot of people, mostly men driving fast. The stereotype is true. And we will kill maybe vulnerable people. And this is like a typical ethics principle. You need to protect vulnerable people. And I don't have an answer. This is my real ethical dilemma. So you're saving responsible people and killing many less vulnerable people. But it still is an ethical dilemma. And I think every culture may have a different answer for that. For example, the typical example they did in MIT, for example, if you need to hit someone, you will hit the old person or the young person. In some culture, you try to save the old person because maybe that person gained his right to live. Another say, in other cases, say, no, you hit the old person because the young person has all the life in front of her or him. But it's not a trivial issue.
These are the very important problems of AI and the ones that are very hard to solve.
These are social problems. They're not AI problems.
Exactly. Well, as most of the social problems, they are very complex to solve by the nature of social networks, social interactions, and how you prioritize and make decisions in that complex space. Now, I have to ask you this question. The impression is that these sort of questions are not the questions that many people are asking about AI. What you hear talking a lot about is the existential risk. Is AI going to kill us all? Is AI going to build Terminators and so forth? What's your position on that? Do we need to spend so much energy on that? Or is it more a distraction for the kind of problems you just talked about?
Now that you mentioned Terminator, this year will be 40 years of Terminator. Many people will not realize that it's so old. And also, I think today was when Steve Jobs launched the Macintosh. And the first time that you had this hello set. So 40 years old too. So it's interesting how technology advances. Now, I don't believe in AGI. You knew my answer. So I think this is not only distraction, but it's like it's a lack of lucidity. And even from famous people that step down from multinationals to start talking about the risk of this. So if we are the creators of this technology, we need to be in control of the technology. So I believe we can. It's our choice. And if we don't exercise our choice, then we're in trouble. But then it's like we are stupid. We are less intelligent than whatever we build if we don't do that. Now, even if AGI is possible, I don't think it's really possible, especially if you learn from ourselves. Like, if we're not perfect, why a system will be bad, much better? But who knows? So maybe we will find a way that they can learn better than us. And now, there are two different things here. One is that more probable people using technology that not so advanced will use it against people that don't have the technology, which is the history of humankind, like colonization and conquers and all that. So this is more probable for me, but in the future. And the other one is that if I create something that's more smarter than us, and if you look at the planet, I know what to do. I mean, look at the planet. There's a parasite on the planet. What do you do with parasites? Well, sorry, I need to do something that looks bad, but it's the only way to save the planet. And then we have this existential threat. But it's not because they are bad, it's because we are bad. The problem is us, not them. Now, the real problems that are happening today, and this is, I'm really worried. For example, if we do this risk assessment, AGI, yes, can affect all the planet, but for me, the probability of that happening is very, very small, and it's in the future. But today we have discrimination, algorithmic discrimination. Today we have mental issues. So with people believing that ChatGPT is like a person, we have had already a suicide. We had people talking to dead people, their relatives, because they fine-tune a model with them. There are people training psychologists, like digital psychologists with all the writings of famous psychologists. And we don't know if these things will work well all the time. And maybe on average will work well. But again, we go back to the problem. What happens if it doesn't work like 1% of the time and then someone commits a suicide or makes a decision that will affect all their life? Well, today AI is using data of other people to decide our future. Also, that's not scientific. No one has proved that we come from a priority distribution and we can use data from other people unless it's something genetic like health or on deciding what is our problem. So we have all these things that we have ethical issues, we have pseudoscience issues, and so on. And we're not taking care of that today. And this is the real problem. So for me, it's a distraction. And that's why it's so important, this legitimacy and competence. Because this will say, okay, think about it. Just think a little bit about it. And instead of thinking on how much money you will make.
I tend to lean towards your position, even if I might have a little bit different opinion on AGI. I think, yeah, it can be a thing.
Why we want to do it? Even if we agree that we can do it, why we want to do it? I wouldn't do it because then I know the result, right?
Well, it's related to the existential risk as well. That when the risk somehow is that even if we don't want to do it, it will emerge.
I don't believe of this from basically from mass, because this is just mass. From mass, I don't think will emerge something like that.
Wow. I love this conversation. I could go on for hours on this topic specifically, but we talked a lot because it is the important thing to talk about, the responsible approach of AI and the problems around AI and we can address them. But trying to take a positive note, what could be your AI utopia? How would you describe that?
Yeah, I think, for example, another simple regulation should be that whenever you want to use AI, your goal should be basically empowering people. So this is the goal. You need to empower people. Then, for example, you increase their productivity, you complement them, and so on. But for example, some people are thinking on replacing people. I think this should be forbidden. You cannot replace people. I mean, this is a very simple thing. And this would be like a regulation. So you don't replace people, you basically make them better. Now, if we do that, maybe we can say, okay, if we can change the work of a person in a way that that person does only things that he or she likes, then AI in the future, let's say robots or software or whatever, will do everything that we don't like to do. So they will pick up the garbage, they will clean houses, they will whatever we hate. And that will be for me my utopia, like the real renaissance. Everyone in the world will be able to do what they really like, what they really love. For example, we'll have more writers, more painters, more musicians, more thinkers. Imagine the potential of 8 billion people doing what they want. That I think I cannot imagine that, because that will be like a paradise. And of course, if you do something that is useful for society, you will receive a salary because you are doing something that all people appreciate. If you don't want to do anything, maybe we need to look at what we do with those cases, but maybe they need to work. And now the work means doing something that you don't like. But if you have the choice between doing something that you like and something I don't like, I prefer to do something you like and you and I are lucky people that do most of the day things we like, right? So maybe we need two different words for work. One that for things you like and other things that things you don't like. But this is my utopia, like will be the perfect world of like all people doing things that are useful for society. And money is not an issue. And if you want to have a lot of money, I don't know why you need that in that world.
It's a beautiful picture. And I can see the references and I can see similar point of view. It might be related definitely also to a lot of conversation over the last few years on sort of the universal income. Because in a way, many people are realizing this is the direction of travel. Of course, even considering all the issues and problems that inevitably you have to face in a transition phase like this one, do you think we're moving in the right direction? Or do you think that at the moment, the barriers in the way that the society is set up are too big for this sort of utopia?
I think that system, the current system, has the wrong incentive in many ways. So one is that I don't know why people want to become billionaire and then not have enough lifetime to spend the money. In that sense, a very good example is the former wife of Jeff Bezos, Mackenzie Scott. Because she's given away like a lot of money, like billions of money. That makes sense. Like if you cannot use it, why not give it away? The second incentive is the wrong incentive, the stock market, where you're optimizing, you need to optimize for the next quarter. So it's not a long-term optimization. We know that in science, we know that you need to optimize for the long term, not for the short term, but there's no incentive to do that in companies. So that's another wrong incentive. So I would say that this hyper-capitalism plus short-term incentives is two things that we need to change to become a better society. And this has nothing to do with politics. I think it's that just to be more human. I love this meme that I saw once that that you never see a chimpanzee trying to have all the bananas in the jungle, but humans do, although we come from chimpanzees, so not from bonobos. So this is the question, why we are doing this change? Is this is really part of humans, or this is just some outliers that are very successful and change the world in ways that they shouldn't? I don't have the answer. I'm not a philosopher, but I see things, and I think these are the main problems. So the system needs to be changed from inside, and it's not easy to change. Unless you want to have a revolution. This is the way that in past history, things have changed, like revolutions. Like, but I prefer to think that we have learned from that and we can do it in a different way.
If you look at that, there is always a question, do humans as a collective really learn? And sometimes if you look back in history, it seems we don't.
So no, we tend to
do again, always the same thing.
Not only we don't learn, but also we have this cognitive bias that we change the world in the way that we want to see it. For example, how many wars are active today, Creed? Do you know that? How many real conflicts in the world there are? We know two. Today we know two.
I would say tens in order of magnitudes, a few tens. There are many small that we don't know about. Maybe I would be surprised if there are more than 100.
If you talk about conflicts, you will be right. But if you talk about wars, we have like an arbitrary definition of what is a war. It has to do with the number of casualties. And this is more close to 20. But we don't talk about that. That's another part of the problem. We live in these bubbles of information, and it's very hard to get out of them unless you study and you read and you go for it.
It's definitely also human bias in the way we operate. And again, it goes back to your point of regulating technology. Definitely the technology industry, and we have a lot of bad examples of that, they try, then they are constantly trying to exploit this bias. On the other, on the positive end, I really like one of the points, your points earlier about trying to take this sort of long-term view, because that's what's going to save us. A few episodes ago in the podcast, I was talking with another guest, John Wilshire, and we're talking about a very interesting book from Stuart Brand, which is The Clock of the Long Now, which is really trying to think about, okay, how does time influence our society, and how can you sort of push for this long-term view? Because we know it's beneficial, but naturally we don't go for it as individuals. But it is beneficial for society, and the more we do that, the usually more we reap benefit.
Without the right leaders, some countries can show us the way. And there are some countries that in some sense do part of this. For example, I would say, and these are mainly islands, I guess, New Zealand, Iceland. There are cases where they are doing things in a bit different way, and they have more happy societies.
I always wonder, though, is it scalable? What I mean with that, we're usually talking of smaller countries that have a sort of a fairly healthy economy. And in a way, they have a lot of resources per inhabitant in a way and another. Okay. And then when you get to more densely populated country, can we do that? I agree with you. There are definitely some models that are working. And I don't understand sometimes. I ask myself, is the problem in the model, in the sense that it can be scaled up, or it's a cultural problem that other countries just don't want to adopt that?
I think it has to do with complex systems, but I don't think it's a scalability problem. I think it's, for example, let's say you go to China and they say, okay, no army. Now there's no army. Now, if all the money that you spend in armies goes to people, well, you can do a lot of things. That's true also in the US and many other countries. But the problem is that you can't say no army while there are other countries with armies. So it's the problem is like you need to change everything at once. Like, okay, we decide not to have more armies. Okay, dismantle. But this is the problem. But some countries say, no, keep mine. And then you cannot do it. And I think this is the main problem today. It's not a problem of scalability. It's a problem of the changes need to be done like together. And this synchronicity, that's the possible part. It's more like reaching I would say in physics, like these points of where things change completely. We need to reach this point and change like that.
Phase transitions, yeah.
Exactly. A phase transition. We need to have a phase transition, but phase transitions are not easy.
That's the thing. When you are into a phase transition, by definition, the system enters into what is called the critical state, and you don't really know what's going to happen. The beauty, though, of course, is that a critical state is usually a state of innovation, because a lot of things can happen, but it's also very difficult to control. I think I was listening the other day to Sean Carroll's podcast, and the interviewee, Ricard Soleil, I think he's based in Barcelona, as far as I know.
Yeah, yeah. Yes,
and
he's
talking
him.
About the
I
fact that most of the complex systems, in particular biological but of intelligent systems, they live and operate in a critical state, because the critical state is the place where you can more adapt and react to change more easily. And we could definitely clearly now collectively feel we're getting to this sort of transition, and definitely we feel AI is going to play a role about that. Thanks, Alan. This conversation was really fascinating, and it's been went very, very broadly, as personally like, and it actually shows where, as you mentioned, that complexity can touch so many different points, and they're all connected together. And sometimes it's wrong, which is sort of the point I always try to make. It's wrong to just take the approach and trying to slice things in a way that you can control, because the whole point is that a system acts as a system that has different parts, and you cannot just isolate them if you want to understand how it behaves.
Yeah, and complexity is something that we should talk more, because, for example, we only using averages. Like, say, okay, this system has an accuracy of 90%. But the truth is that probably for trivial problems, the accuracy is 100%. And for complex problems, the accuracy is 80% in the best case. So it's more like continuum, another continuum of different complexity of problems. And we are looking at an average that really doesn't say anything, because we don't need the system to solve trivial problems. We need the system to solve complex problems. And we are not looking at that. So it's related to this thing that not all mistakes are equal. Also, not all instances are equal, and we need to look at them differently. And we are not doing that too. And we didn't talk about something important when we talk about regulation, is that regulation doesn't hurt innovation. Because it's related to what you said about critical systems. When you are in a critical situation, you innovate more. So when you have more restrictions, you innovate more. And also you innovate better. Because I think what is very good about regulation is that you kill bad innovation.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Well, we had a similar conversation with different outcome. This episode of the podcast that was with an entrepreneur, Bruce Sinclair. So definitely, as you might brought a different perspective that. But I'm really happy that you managed to bring this on. And yeah, I think that this conversation kind of leads naturally to the last question, to the question that I ask all the guests, and I'm sure I'm going to get another fascinating answer from you. So what are the characteristics of a leader who embraces complexity?
For me, it should be a person from where I can learn from. Also, a person that will ask me questions such that I find out what I'm missing instead of trying to give me advice. I don't think that's a real leader. And then maybe show me things that I will not consider. For example, I have learned that planning is not so good. So maybe we shouldn't do too many plans. Also that you need to embrace uncertainty. Certainty is, again, related to living in a critical system. How to adapt. And some people hate uncertainty. I love it. And also you need to be very careful about the human component. Like, you need one rotten apple to destroy a team. And if you have all these things together, things go very well. Another thing I learned is that if you have two people from every culture, that's better, because then they can talk to each other when they have a problem. But if you're alone, that's more difficult.
The importance of this question in this sense is that, of course, you're not a psychologist or sociologist, but you're a leader. And in that sense, you can help others to maybe ask themselves the right question.
I guess if you believe that you're a leader, then you are not.
That's a fair point. I think that kind of closes very nicely this episode. And again, I really appreciate the breadth and the so many different topics we covered. Thank you very much. And yeah, hopefully we're going to have again you soon, and we can continue some of the conversation that we left there.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank Thanks for listening to this episode of Engines of Creation. I hope you enjoy this comprehensive conversation about the nuanced and critical considerations that must be addressed as we navigate the evolving landscape of artificial intelligence with Ricardo Baeza Yates, a real deep dive into the ethical and practical dimension of artificial intelligence. If you want to learn more, be sure to follow Engines of Creation and leave us a rating and a review, please. And don't hesitate to share this episode on social media and with friends and colleagues who might be interested. This podcast counts on you to grow and help other people to understand and embrace complexity. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to reach out to angelsofcreation@mastrodonato.co. I'll be glad to continue the conversation. Angels of Creation will be back very soon with a great episode about innovation with a real chief innovation officer. Arrivederci.